mouth.
Word of 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 mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Taylor Quimby in for Virginia Prescott. In early 1997, the United Network of Organ Sharing, or UNOS, publicly addressed a viral email chain that was warning travelers about the dangers of organ theft. The email claimed people were being kidnapped and drugged, only to wake up in a bathtub filled with ice and either one or both of their kidneys removed. UNOS dismissed the emails as a hoax and cited the work of a Washington Post reporter who, in 1991, traced the origin of the myth to a rejected movie script. Since the mid-1980s, UNOS has been tracking reports of organ theft and claims to have found no evidence to support such rumors. And yet, organ theft horror stories persist in the United States and abroad. Anthropologist Nancy Shepper-Hughes spent her career investigating the worldwide rumors about a global market for human organs and tissues and found that the stories were, quote, true at that indeterminate level between fact and metaphor. Ethan Waters is a journalist who has contributed to the New York Times Magazine, Mother Jones, and Esquire, among others. He profiled Nancy Shepper-Hughes for Pacific Standard's Medical Issue in an article titled The Organ Detective. Ethan, thanks so much for speaking with me today.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
So let's start with how exactly did Shepper-Hughes first begin her investigation on organ theft?
Well, the rumors came to her when she was down in Brazil working on her now very well-known book called Death Without Weeping. And she was down there documenting poverty in Brazil the high death rates among children and the ways in which the medical establishment wasn't helping very much down there. And among her sources, she began to hear these stories of vans along dirt roads picking up children and then the children's bodies later turning up in dumpsters and on the roadsides, you know, eviscerated from their organs. And the local population was just certain that these children were being kidnapped and murdered for their organs. So Nancy, being that she was charting the death records and going to the, you know, the cemeteries and the mortuaries every day, had a good reason to be skeptical about these stories. She was seeing no eviscerated bodies show up. When she wrote about it later in Death Without Weeping, she ended up coming to the conclusion that these stories were not, in fact, literally true, but they were true at the intermediate level, as you say, between fact and metaphor, by which she said that they spoke to the other difficulties that this population went through and their really troubled relationship with the medical establishment. She wasn't going to dismiss them, but there was no actual evidence of children being murdered for their organs.
So the idea is that healthcare is a service that works primarily for the elite, people with money, and because of that, these stories were sort of generated out of fear?
Out of fear and out of the fact that was exactly true, that this population knew that the healthcare benefited the rich and by and large left them to die in many cases when they could have been helped.
Organ donation was really just an experimental procedure still in the 70s. So at what point did the market for an organ trade become a real worldwide market in the first place?
So in the early and mid-90s, the technology really began to spread around the world. It spread across Asia and throughout the United States. And then there was a drug called cyclosporine that came online that helped with the rejection of organs, which basically increased the ability of people to get organs from many more people than they would have otherwise. And that at that point, it really began to spread around the world. And the technology spread much faster than the laws and understandings and ways of thinking about it. So there was a great deal of controversy over the 90s as to where these organs were coming from, what constituted brain death, whether you could take organs from dead bodies. And there was a lot of controversy. So the medical establishment on sort of a global scale had to really run to catch up with the spread of this brand new technology.
So in your article, you sort of profile Shepper-Hughes crisscrossing the globe looking for evidence of an organ black market, which, of course, is a black market. In 1984, the National Organ Transplant Act outlawed the sale of human organs, at least in the U.S. But Shepper-Hughes did manage to find some evidence of people buying and selling kidneys here in the United States. How was she able to find that link?
Well, the turn really came in the mid-90s when she went to a conference with a lot of other transplant surgeons, and she was asked to address these rumors. And in the process of talking about these rumors, she began to realize that there was indeed a great deal of controversy about how organs were being procured. There was a black market where people were being paid for things like kidneys. There was tremendous abuses within mortuaries where people would take not the live organs, like hearts and kidneys, but skin and tissue and cornea from dead bodies all over the world. And she began to realize that this was really a rich area for an anthropologist to begin to try to understand what was going on a global scale. And indeed, as you say, she began to travel the world really aggressively, going to Moldova and the Philippines and South Africa and Brazil, trying to chart mainly the kidney trade, which is, of course, the trade where you can sell one of your kidneys and have another one that still works. And there was a tremendous sort of multicultural, multi-border black market. And Nancy worked exceedingly hard for many, many years to try to sort of put her finger on what was going on and how those interconnections were happening, who the brokers were, who the surgeons were. And eventually, she did managed to trace it to American shores, and she got basically an email at one point from someone inside an organization called United Lifeline, and he basically disclosed to her that this was a organization that brought pairs of people to the United States to major hospitals, and it would be a donor and a recipient. They'd come to a hospital and say, "We have this donor that wants to altruistically give to this recipient. We'll pay basically cash for this procedure. There'll be no insurance. It'll all be profits for the hospital." And indeed, what was happening was that that donor was often getting paid, was always getting paid, which is illegal by U.S. and most international laws.
I'm speaking with the journalist Ethan Waters about the illegal organ trade, which has long been the focus of anthropologist Nancy Shepherd Hughes. Now, we think of anthropologists being, conventionally speaking anyway, objective as, I guess, putting science first. But Nancy was actually instrumental in getting the head of United Lifeline, a man named Isaac Rosenbaum, indicted for his role in brokering illegal organs.
Yes. So Nancy, by her own admission, bends a lot of the conventional rules of anthropology. And to her great credit, she addresses these the ways in which she is, you know, outside the norm. One of the ways she's outside the norm certainly is the idea that you would take your source material and turn around and take it straight to law enforcement. And a lot of other people in anthropology would say, "I would never do that." Nancy was looking at it and saying, "I see an international crime going on here. I see donors being exploited. I see them getting no aftercare. This is something that I have to intervene with, and I am not going to let ideas of professional ethics get in the way of me stopping something that is really, truly a tragedy." This is not the only way she's pushed the boundaries of anthropology and social science. She has done things like basically gone undercover. She's gone to places and claimed to be a person that was looking for a kidney, that wanted to buy a kidney. She's negotiated the price with, you know, potential donors. She's walked into hospitals, you know, saying, like, "I'm Dr. Shepherd Hughes and I need this information," assuming that people weren't going to understand that that doctor there was her PhD in anthropology.
This does not sound like the life of an academic. This sounds like the life of a police officer.
She really is her own, you know, there's no one in the anthropology world that I can really compare her to. She has this idea of what she calls being a militant anthropologist. And that idea goes all the way back to long before she started in the organ world, actually, when she tried to rally everyone in the profession to, as she puts it, to sort of become class traitors, to push against bourgeois institutions like universities and hospitals, and to express solidarity with the sources and basically join them in their fights against oppression. And she has had a great deal of influence over the practice of anthropology. There are a lot of people in the profession that think very highly of her, and indeed there's a lot of people in the profession that think that she's dragging the profession into sort of a moral model of anthropology, and you're not really actually, you know, studying the world in the appropriate shades of gray.
You've been following Shepherd Hughes for a few years now, and you actually joined her at the sentencing hearing for Rosenbaum 2 summers ago. What were those testimonies like, and what was her response?
So Rosenbaum got sentenced a couple years ago in a court in New Jersey, and I accompanied Nancy into the hearing, and there was testimony by a doctor from Albert Einstein Hospital. There was testimony by a donor who had been paid for his kidney. There was testimony by a family member of the person that received the organ. And it was very interesting because Nancy, as we sat there, you know, had sort of a disparaging comment for every character in the courtroom. She really felt like that the doctor was not being fully disclosing what he knew. She felt the prosecution wasn't asking the right questions. She felt the family member, you know, could have donated her own organ instead of buying one. It was kind of remarkable, and it reminded me of something that Nancy wrote very early on in her career about what a medical anthropologist should do. She said, a medical anthropologist should become a court jester. It should become the mocking and dissenting voice from the sidelines. And I realized sort of as I was sitting there that she'd almost become exactly that for me, this sort of mocking court jester, making disparaging comments about everyone in the courtroom. It was a really interesting moment.
Throughout the article, you get the sense that Nancy finds empathy with virtually everybody in the black market organ process. We're talking about the donor, the recipient, even the brokers, the people who arrange transplants, but not so much the doctors. And it seems so strange that given that she operates in these shades of gray, you know, that she's, you know, at some times an anthropologist, at some times an interrogator, at some times an undercover cop, that she wouldn't be able to find the shades of gray and the nuance for the doctors and surgeons who are actually conducting transplants.
Right. I noticed that in her work as well. So when she talks about the brokers and when she talks about the donors, and she has this remarkable ability to see detail, to pick up nuances. It's when she steps back and she talks about the transplant community, and she says things like, the transplant community is like child abusing priests, that they protect their own in this way. And she said things like, doctors are creating a need for organs that don't exist. And transplant technology is the modern form of human sacrifice. Like, it's these moments when she steps back and looks at the transplant community that her rhetoric becomes really white hot and almost, almost sounds like the trailer for a horror movie at times. It's so outlandish. And it does stand in contrast, in my mind, to that more subtle work that she does for the donor, for the broker, her really good work of exposing this world that people really didn't understand or know existed. I'm much more impressed by the on-the-ground anthropology she does than that global view of the transplant world.
Well, Ethan, thank you so much for talking about this with us today.
Oh, I appreciate it. Thank you so much for having me on.
Ethan Waters is a journalist who has contributed to the New York Times Magazine, Mother Jones, and Esquire, among others. He wrote about anthropologist Nancy Shepper Hughes for Pacific Standard's Medical Issue. And you can find a link to that article, The Organ Detective, at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. Between Jeb Bush and Hillary Clinton, there's a pretty good chance we'll see some familiar names on the ballot for 2016. Up next, why powerful political families may actually be benefiting women in politics. That story when Word of Mouth continues. This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Taylor Quimby, in for Virginia Prescott. Bush, Romney, Clinton, Kennedy. When tracing the branches of the U.S. government, you can't help but notice that some family trees have deeper roots than others. But while some might see the omnipresence of political dynasties in American politics as a cause for great concern, one writer has observed a surprising benefit. Annie Lowry writes about politics and economic policy for New York Magazine, where you'll find her article, Why Political Dynasties Are Good for Women. And Annie, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you for having me.
So beyond the Bushes and the Clintons, what evidence suggests that political dynasties still hold that much sway in American government today?
There are a number of political scientists and other sort of researchers of government who have looked at Congress and have looked at the presidency, obviously, basically traced how many people are related to each other. And when you look at these kind of like almanacs, what's amazing is that throughout history, there have been a lot of people with family members who have also served in government. And that's true now, even though the country has gotten much, much bigger. There's like, I think it's about 9% of members of Congress have a family member who has also served in Congress in some capacity. And if you sort of broaden that out and say, you know, if you are a person, you know, with a family tie to somebody who served in a state office or a local office, it's an even higher percentage. So we actually have a lot of evidence for this. And you know, looking at the presidency, just the presidency, 8 presidents have come from the same 4 families. So, you know, the Roosevelts and going back all the way to the Adamses. And, you know, there's a good chance that our next president, whether it's Jeb Bush or Hillary Clinton, is going to have a very, very close relation who's been in office.
Now, what's so funny about this is that I would think that if you asked anybody whether or not this was a good thing, you would find that most people really dislike the concept. So if Americans seem to dislike the notion, why are some families able to hold so much political sway, do you think?
So Americans, you're absolutely right. Americans hate this. If you ask
right.
them whether it's a good thing that so many people are related to other people in office, they say it's terrible. They hate the idea of political dynasties. And of course, we're like an anti-dynastic country in some sense, right?
Well, sounds very undemocratic.
Exactly. We like shuffled off this monarchy and, you know, and we have one like something that looks a little bit uncomfortably like one here. But the thing that comes with being in one of these political families is that you instantly have a leg up in terms of name recognition. You also have a leg up in terms of fundraising and just understanding how political campaigns work and how politics work. And kind of a third piece is also that you know that it's an option. You know, maybe you have somebody in your family who said, hey, you know, you'd be great at running for office too. Have you ever thought about, you know, a career in public service in that sense? And so I think that all three of those things are working to sort of nudge people to go into to run for office if they have family members who've done it.
Now, do you think those are the same factors that might benefit women who are trying to get into politics, or do they have special factors that might be the case here? Or is it really just about the resources and the family name?
So I would say that women benefit or are encouraged to run through all of those pathways. But that third one is maybe a little bit unusual and different for women. So there's a ton of research that shows that one of the reasons that women don't run for office as often as men do is that it's unusually important for them to get tapped or nudged to run. Very often women will say, well, it wasn't my idea to run. It was somebody else who said, you know what, you would make a great city councilwoman or a great member of Congress. Have you ever thought about that? So, you know, whereas men are much more likely to say, this was my idea, you know, I looked at it in the mirror in the morning and thought, hey, you'd make a great senator or whatever. So in terms of, I think one of the reasons that so many women have family ties is that they get tapped to run. You know, they have people in their families to say, you know, hey, you're civically minded. You might be really good at this if you thought about it.
Well, that makes sense to me. But what does this say about the state of the political system overall if the easiest way for a woman to break into politics is by relation? Because I think some might say that political dynasties aren't creating political progress for all women, just the ones with the right last names.
Yeah, you know, I don't know that it's necessarily easier for women, right? Women and men, men are much more likely to run for office, but men and women lose their races for office at about the same rate. So, that is kind of a normal question. It's really interesting to think about, but I'm not sure it's necessarily easier. But I agree with you that the biggest picture is that the United States has trouble getting anybody to run for office. And I think if you're looking at a national level, not simply because the job of being a congressperson, a man or a woman in Congress, is really unpleasant. It's very grueling. And you know, it's considered to be a tough thing to break into. They spend a lot of time fundraising. And I think that there's now a lot of organizations, though, who want to reach out to all sorts of communities that are historically and are currently underrepresented in office. So people of color, you know, people from lower income backgrounds, and to build those pipelines up and say, hey, you know, it would be a nice thing if our government looked a little bit more like our country does. Just in general, I think that there's a real issue, which is that people don't want to become politicians, and I think with good reason in many cases.
Well, let's jump forward 50 years from now. And this is totally speculative, but do you think political dynasties will still be a necessity, say, 50 years from now for women's entrance into high office? Or is it possible that the sort of benefits you're talking about might just dissipate as politics become more gender neutral?
as the country got bigger, you would expect to see, you know, Congress is not getting much bigger, not getting bigger, the country is getting bigger, right?
Right.
I think it would make sense that you would see fewer and fewer people with these family ties. And, you know, hopefully you have more fresh faces coming in and running. But the truth is that the value of having kind of a Clinton name or a Bush name is so great that I don't think that they're going to go anywhere. And, you know, there's actually research. There's a guy at Harvard who looked at this and who said that candidates who have a familial tie, they win their elections more often than people without them do. And so I think that it's a really powerful factor, even if it's one that, you know, Americans really don't like.
So whatever happens in 2016, you might not be too surprised if, say, Chelsea Clinton found her way into politics over the next 20, 30 years?
Yeah, exactly. George P. Bush. I think we probably have any number of candidates coming down the pike.
Well, Annie, thanks so much for sharing this with us.
All right. Thanks so much for having me.
Annie Lowrey writes about politics and economic policy for New York Magazine. And you can find a link to her article, Why Political Dynasties Are Good for Women. That's at wordofmouthradio.org. And we move from domestic politics to a not-so-sweet international crisis. We're going to find out why the import of Cadbury chocolate made overseas has been banned in the United States and what that means for chocolate lovers after the news.
Word of mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Taylor Quimby, in for Virginia Prescott. Are you a fan of toffee crisps or flake bars? Does our American imitation of Cadbury chocolate leave you with a stale aftertaste? Well, if that's the case, then we might just have some bad news for you. A result of a settlement between Hershey's Chocolate Company and LBB Imports, that stands for Let's Buy British, has banned the import of Cadbury chocolate made overseas. This decision has angered lots of chocolate fans of British goodies here in the U.S., and New York Times reporter Tatiana Schlossberg joins us to talk about this perhaps not-so-sweet deal. Tatiana, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
So we'll just get right to the heart of the matter. What is happening here? Why is Hershey's company stopping the import of chocolate?
So Hershey's, a couple of years ago, bought a licensing agreement from Cadbury's and bought the factories so that they could make, you know, American versions of Cadbury's chocolate here in the United States. And part of that licensing agreement means that they're the only people who can sell Cadbury's chocolate in the U.S. And so they are now trying to stop companies that import British chocolates from importing British chocolates like Dairy Milk or Flake Bars or whatever, and selling them in the United States. And the Toffee Crisp issue, along with Yorkie Bars and Rolos and Kit Kats, is because the wrapping looks too similar, the names are too similar to Hershey's products. And so that is a trade dress infringement. And that Hershey's is worried that customers or shoppers will confuse these British imports for their products and dilute the Hershey's brand.
It's kind of funny because you mentioned Kit Kat bars. You know, that's not what I think of as what people are going to get when they're looking for British chocolate. You know, the flake bars, you're looking for the stuff that you can't get here in the U.S., right?
Right, right. Well, British Kit Kat bars are different. I mean, not wildly different. but, yeah, you're right that it's mostly, you know, the stuff that we don't have here, like a flake bar or timeout or whatever your favorite chocolate bar might be.
Now, you in your article talk about a lot of businesses that depend on imported chocolates. Do you have any examples? I mean, around here, I don't think there's as many, but how will some of these stores stay open and what are their options going to be?
So I don't think that they have a lot of options because unless, you know, the settlement is reversed or other companies, you know, find a way to keep importing British chocolate. But yeah, I talked to one woman who worked at a small importer and she said she doesn't, you know, it's chocolate sales is 50% of her business, 60% at Christmas.
Wow.
And so she doesn't think she'll be able to stay open. And there's, you know, Tea and Sympathy in New York, which has a tea shop and a restaurant. I mean, a tea shop, a grocery store, and a fish and chips shop. You know, they'll be able to get by because they sell lots of other things, but they won't have their chocolate cake anymore because it's made with melted down Yorkie bars.
Oh, that is just a shame.
Yeah.
So American Cadbury chocolate's made with a lot of additives. And the first ingredient listed, I guess, on the package is sugar, as opposed to British Cadbury chocolate, which is made with vegetable oils. And the first ingredient is milk. So what? Why the difference between chocolate from the two nations?
Well, I think a lot of it has to come. It comes down to shelf life in the U.S. and maybe we like things a little bit sweeter rather than sort of richer. I don't know about your taste, but I like British chocolate better. But what somebody told me is that the additives and the using more sugar, Hershey's has to make chocolate that can withstand the vast variety of temperatures in the United States. So, Arizona as well as Maine or New Hampshire. So they have to be able to, last and not melt. And so most of the additives kind of prevent chocolate from melting.
So you did an informal taste test comparing the Cadbury Dairy Milk bars. And what'd you find?
Yeah, the British, I just tried a sort of a dairy milk, which is a plain milk chocolate.
Uh-huh.
And the British one is much richer, sort of fudgier when you bite into it. Not quite as sweet, but very chocolatey. And the American one is sort of thinner, and it does have that kind of stale aftertaste. That's not super pleasant.
And what do you think about, the reaction? I mean, is there any chances that this could get reversed just because of the sheer animosity that chocolate lovers are going to have towards Hershey's at this point?
I don't know. I have a friend who's from England who told me that he was starting a petition. So, there's all kinds of citizen activism. But Hershey's is a pretty gigantic corporation, and they have a solid hold on the American market. So I don't know. I mean, I hope for the sake of variety that there's a way to, that this maybe will swing back in the other direction, but I don't know for now.
Well, Tatiana, thanks so much for filling us in.
Thank you so much for having me.
Tatiana Schlossberg is a writer for the New York Times and author of the article After a Deal, British Chocolates Won't Cross the Pond. You can find a link to it on our website, wordofmouthradio.org. Mexico is widely considered to be the birthplace of chocolate, and nowhere is it held in higher esteem than in Oaxaca. It's said every man, woman, and child in the city consumes chocolate at least once every day. Reporter Mary Stuckey went to Pilar Cabrera, a native of Oaxaca and well-known chef there, to learn the secrets of making a special kind of Mexican hot chocolate known as chocolate atole.
We're at Chocolate Mayordomo, one of the very first chocolate stores to open in Oaxaca. We're buying the raw ingredients for chocolate atole, perhaps the most popular form of hot chocolate in Mexico.
And here we stop in the first place and start the business of chocolate in Oaxaca, Chocolate Mayordomo. Here we have in front of us have cacao, cinnamon, almonds, and sugar. I prefer more proportion of almonds and less sugar. This is the flavor I learned from my grandmom. Me puedes vender media molienda de este.
Okay, so she is putting these cacao beans, like big coffee beans, really, on an old-fashioned scale and weighing them in a big metal dish. After we buy the ingredients, we cross the street to where the grinders are. About half a dozen work in one huge shop whose doors are open to the busy street. Ancient grinding machines pulverize the cacao beans, almonds, sugar, and cinnamon. And then men mix the ingredients into a paste by hand using a knife. Now, even though we have the chocolate paste flavored with almond, cinnamon, and sugar, we're not going to make our own chocolate atole today. Instead, we'll take a short taxi ride to the market to join in a morning ritual in Oaxaca. This market is right next door to the school Pilar attended as a child.
We come into the market almost every day. Yeah. And for me, my best place is Comedor Mari. They prepare the best chocolate we have here in the city. We call chocolate atole. Doña Mari, venimos a visitarla.
Pilar greets the proprietor, Maria Ramirez Vasquez. The 70-year-old, wearing an apron and long braids, stands in front of a huge pot. Inside, dried corn is boiling in water. This is the corn atole, the base ingredient in the hot chocolate drink.
people cook the corn, dry corn, one day in advance. And this water, thick, thick atole, because boiling, and at the end combined with the chocolate, without almonds, and a lot of cinnamon.
But there's a special way in which the thick corn and the chocolate are combined.
And use the molinillo to bring foamy on the top of the chocolate.
The molinillo is a foot-long wooden whisk. It's a lot of work to use it. There's no milk in this drink, but even without it, Maria whips up a substantial foam. The foam is said to contain the energy of the person who made the drink. That person must be a woman, whose worth as a cook is determined by how much foam she can create. Maria tells Pilar she makes 30 liters of chocolate atole every day to sell in the market. That's a lot of whisking.
At the end, serve in a big bowl with a wooden spoon. We stir the mixture, and then we drink it. And I feel the delicious flavor of the chocolate, and the combination with the corn atole is great. Do you want to try it?
Nothing like our hot chocolate. It's completely different. This isn't so sweet.
Yeah.
And no milk in this.
No milk. Doña Marie. Nos vemos.
Time to go. Chocolate atole is a breakfast drink, and the morning is passing. As we leave, we spot two schoolgirls, heads bent over huge bowls of Doña Maria's hot chocolate.
Bebe chocolate cada día?
Sí.
The girls say they start each day with a bowl of chocolate atole, just like countless generations before them. For the World Vision Report, I'm Mary Stuckey in Oaxaca, Mexico.
The Breaking Bad spinoff Better Call Saul premiered on AMC last night to rave reviews. Up next, we'll hear from the man behind strip mall lawyer Saul Goodman, comedian and actor Bob Odenkirk. A conversation when Word of Mouth returns. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Taylor Quimby, in for Virginia Prescott. Bob Odenkirk is a busy man. After hitting the big time as strip mall lawyer Saul Goodman on Breaking Bad, he's starring in that show's spinoff, Better Call Saul, which debuted on AMC last night. He's also earned praise for his role as small-town sheriff in the TV show Fargo and his restrained acting in 2013's Oscar-nominated film Nebraska. Long before becoming a Hollywood face, he'd reached near-cult status for his contributions to the world of sketch comedy, first as a writer for Saturday Night Live, then The Ben Stiller Show, Late Night with Conan O'Brien, and as co-creator of Mr. Show with David Cross, in which he wrote and played characters ranging from hyper-conservative Dixiecrat senator...
New Mexico! When was the last time anybody was in New Mexico? Be serious. Grand Canyon? Just sitting out there collecting dust. The Great Lakes? Cluttered with water. I believe it's time to sell it. We're taking bids now. Best offer gets it.
To a morally bankrupt British TV producer.
Ronnie, I'm going to put it to you bluntly. How long have you been not drinking?
Terry, I drink all the time. You know me, come on.
No, you come on, Ronnie. What's in this?
Terry, come on, that's for cocaine.
Bull Ronnie, it's fucking baking soda.
A similar array of voices is evident in Odenkirk's debut collection of writings, A Load of Hooey, in which he channels out-of-touch politicians, perpetually dissatisfied critics, and a beleaguered Paul McCartney. Virginia spoke with Bob Odenkirk in October, the day his book was published, and started the conversation by asking him whether comedy was a way to communicate his ideas on the big issues.
Absolutely. It is also a playground to kick things around in. So I don't really feel like I condemn all religion or all politicians. In fact, I don't like people who do that. But comedy and these pieces are a place to ridicule some of the sillier aspects, including the hot-button issues.
I'm thinking of the essay, putting it out there, you know, which begins, if I were running for president, and then you announce you're being transparent, like the character says, I cheated on my wife, Betty, many, many different ways with many, many different people. Do you wish politicians would do that, or are you making fun of this sort of public fascination with private life?
The public fascination with private life. I think we just go too far in digging into people's peccadilloes and caring about them or pretending to care about them. You know, I was not a fan of George Bush, but I don't care if he did cocaine when he was in college. He could have done it 10 times. I don't care. I just want to know what he stands for. You know, is he upright most days? And, you know, how is he going to lead us? And I don't care if Obama smoked pot. He clearly did. And let's move on. We got work to do.
Well, the politician is one voice. You're a politician in another essay. I misspoke. And a number of different voices here. And I wonder, you know, similar to the way that you do sketches, is this how your comedic mind works? You come up with characters and sketches and you start to flesh them out?
Yeah. And in fact, I've done a certain amount of stand-up, and it's sort of the same thing. I enjoy getting a hold of a voice or a point of view, having fun with it and digging in and going places with it. I find that more rewarding than just making observations. Hmm. I mean, it goes back to my childhood. I'm from a family of seven, and our dinner table was a show every night. And we would get up and we would do the people we met that day. It was all clean comedy. My mother is very Catholic. You know, it's just getting a hold of a point of view and seeing how far it can go. I think it is a commentary, though. I mean, when you go look at your point of view, now let's take it further to a comic extent. And if it's ridiculous, then maybe it's ridiculous just on the face of it all across the board.
Yeah, I'm also one of many children, and it was something I wanted to ask you about, because it's funny, dinner table does become the stage, doesn't it? You've got to work out your characters, you've got to work out your shtick if you want to be heard in this crowd.
Yeah, I mean, we would literally get up from the meal.
Oh.
And then acting it out.
You did stand-up at dinner?
Well, I don't know if it was the stand-up, it was characters, and it was more sketch comedy, so I guess it paid off.
And that sketch comedy came across so beautifully in Mr. Show and other things that you've worked on, Saturday Night Live, we mentioned, and Ben Stiller's show. But Mr. Show is kind of a cult classic now and widely considered to be a kind of a watershed moment for alternative comedy. But it was not so popular at the time. What do you think changed Bob Odenkirk? You know, why did it later catch on?
Well, I don't know the answer. My guess is the internet and YouTube and that kind of sharing of short comedy bits has helped us a lot. But the wave of sketch comedy that comes out of the UCB Theater, Second City in Chicago, Improv Olympic in Chicago, and in Los Angeles, and all the classes and all the improv groups and sketch groups, and now all the sketch shows on TV, I don't know where that came from. I do think it's going to be short-lived. I don't think sketch comedy will ever go away, and I hope it doesn't because I love it. But I do think we're living in a little bubble of cultural excitement over sketch comedy, and then everyone will move on to something else. I remember the stand-up boom in the 80s. Do you remember that?
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, that was crazy. We went from having like two clubs in Chicago to having like eight. And then there was, literally comedy, stand-up comedy night, literally every night of the week. Monday night, you could go to a bar and they'd have stand-up night. And if you could write some jokes, you could get paid $20.
But I wonder for you, Bob, you know, you've been kind of a guru to the web generation. You've inspired people. Derek Waters of Drunk History acknowledges you. Adult Swim's Tim and Eric.
Yeah.
How do you feel about being a sort of an elder on the comedy scene?
Well, you know, listen, I understand what you're saying, and it's very nice. I mean, I had mentors like Del Close, one of the great teachers of improvisation, who inspired me to do this. So I know what that's like. I mean, I got to say, I don't do it consciously. I don't think, how can I be a teacher today, or how can I go be important to younger performers? I do my own thing. I write stuff. Right now I'm acting in Better Call Saul, which is a spinoff of Breaking Bad. But I can't help myself when I see a young act, like Tim and Eric sent me their DVDs years ago, and I put it in and I watch it and I think, oh my God, these guys have a voice. I've never seen it before. It's exciting. It's funny. It's weird. It deserves a stage. I can't help but want to call them, talk to them. How are you doing it? Here's what I think you could do. I made a huge mistake when I was young.
What's that?
I've been at Saturday Night Live for 2 years, and I took all the money I had, and I made a one-hour special for TV. I don't know for who, and had costumes and locations, and we shot it, and we edited it, and we did the sound mix. Cost a lot of money. But it did get me some attention. The HBO executives watched it. They called me in for a meeting, and they said, this is really cool. We can't put it on. No one knows who you are. We can't just put that on. No one will let us. But you're good, and we think you're neat. And later I worked on the Ben Stiller Show, which they produced, and then obviously Mr. Show, and I actually did 4 or 5 pilots with that team over at HBO over the years. So I made friends. But here's the thing. I didn't need to make a one-hour special. I could have achieved everything I achieved by shooting a 15-minute sampler. And that's where I think somebody with more experience can give you a shortcut, can see what you're doing and say, here's a couple ideas that can save you 2 years.
Well, let me ask you about that, because now, you know, you've been on Breaking Bad. Now you're developing Better Call Saul with Breaking Bad's showrunner, Vince Gilligan. And this is after years of being, you know, not the face. You were behind the scenes in the writer's room, feeding and partnering with and feeding the careers of a stunning list of comedic talent. So how does that transition to being the face, a more recognizable, a more visible presence, feel to you?
I try not to think about it.
You've got a good face.
I have a doughy face.
Do you?
I do.
Well, you look very authorial in the one where you're wearing glasses, you have a cat on your lap, smoking a
you're
pipe,
awesome.
Holding a glass of wine.
You're awesome. That I did that for you. I did that for you.
I felt it.
And I wanted to do multiple author photos and multiple about the author things. You know, the book is an indulgence. In the end notes, I thank the Lily Guild. And I don't know if you know what gilding the lily means.
I do.
Yeah, because I know that my comedy writer friends, some of them are going to go, great job. I've already had a few. And some of them, are reading it going, oh, he just went on and on with his little ideas. They're going to see that I just dug in and indulged myself. And, you know, hey, that's what the book is, you know?
Bob Odenkirk, last year you co-authored another book, Hollywood Said No, with David Cross. It's kind of a collection of rejected scripts that you'd submitted.
Mm-hmm.
Are things going to be different now that Hollywood seems to be saying a big fat yes?
Yeah, I don't know if it is saying a big fat yes. I mean, look, Vince Gilligan is saying a big fat yes.
Fargo is saying a yes. Alexander Payne is saying a yes. You seem to be quite in demand.
I'm very thankful, and I can't believe it, and I just try to keep my mouth shut and not jinx this little run of luck I have here. I really got to tell you, this show, Better Call Saul, is kind of mind-blowing.
Well, it's supposed to be a prequel. Are we going to see Saul before he has his comb-over, for example, and before he has the inflatable Statue of Liberty in his office?
Yes, you are.
Oh.
I can't tell you much, but I can tell you that.
Okay.
And I can tell you that Vince Gilligan is, and Peter Gould, they're the two creators of the show, are just setting new standards for me for the writing I'm reading and the work I get to do. And I can't wait to see it and share it with people. And it's just been a crazy challenge and a joy to do it. And I don't know. I don't know what to say. I mean, I don't know what to say to good fortune. I'm much better at talking about failure than I am with talking about good fortune. I don't know what to do with that.
Bob Odenkirk, I want to thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much.
Better call Saul. Better call Saul. You want to tell the world.
That's Virginia Prescott speaking with actor, comedian, and writer Bob Odenkirk, star of the new AMC show and Breaking Bad spinoff, Better Call Saul. Thanks for joining us today. If you like what you heard, there's more at wordofmouthradio.org. And don't forget you can follow us, send us your feedback, or even share your ideas for the program on Facebook and on Twitter. After all, the most fascinating stories do tend to travel by word of mouth. I'm Taylor Quimby, in for Virginia Prescott. Join us for more Word of Mouth tomorrow at 2 on New Hampshire Public Radio.